Today's Dead Idea, this is part four of our continuing series on the world's oldest writing system, cuneiform, and today we've got something actually extra special. We are dining with the Sumerians, and not just the Sumerians, but also my lovely wife Rachel. So, join us for food, beer, and music, a veritable orgy of Sumerian delights. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. The music we just heard was composed by Rachel Westhoff, my lovely wife, for whom chickpea flour is always appropriate. And by the way, that comes from a Sumerian proverb. Chickpea flour is appropriate for every woman in the palace, which was introduced to us by none other than our other co-hosts for today. And that would be Anna.
Who also answers to my recording name, the Big Bapier.
And Nick.
Soundtrack was played on a really vintage synth today, wasn't it?
Yes. Like 5,000 years ago synth. Yeah. And we have a special co-host today, Rachel.
Hi.
Thank you.
I never knew you were Sumerian.
She has a Sumerian look about her.
That's true.
Kind
you
of blackhead. I'm really excited about this. So yeah, this is going to be really fun. We're actually going to eat Sumerian food and drink Sumerian beer today, believe it or not. So yeah, we are pulling out all the stops today. And I do have to wonder if we really realize the irony of doing a cooking show on an audio-only format. And apparently we don't.
We'll smack our lips a lot.
I plan to chew into the mic for the entirety of it.
But you will be able to see pictures of everything that we do today on Facebook. So we'll put that on Facebook and we'll put it on our website, which is www.deadideas.net. So definitely check it out there. And by the way, everybody, today, obviously, we're not going to be able to have perfect audio quality. There's going to be a lot of like chewing, clinking of things and whatnot. So just work with us on this. And also, we're doing the epic and epics now, where we've announced we are no longer worried about time. So it might go a little long, but hey, it's going to be fun. So, okay. All right. Okay.
I got to say, A+ for presentation.
Yeah, no kidding.
Ooh, almonds in a liquid. The amino acids or something?
Or something.
Okay, so anyway, chickpea flour is appropriate for every woman in the palace. Yeah, it was a proverb from ancient Sumeria. The meaning of it completely escapes us, although we can speculate. Why is chickpea flour appropriate for every woman in the palace?
I always assumed it was an advertising slogan.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Or we have to do it by
the chickpea flour council.
We learned about this proverb from a very specific place, which was
Anna's dad.
My dad.
Which more specifically, a CD he gave you?
Yeah, it was somebody, I forget who, it's called The Flood, and it's recordings of basically, I think, the retelling of The Flood from, what was it, the Epic of Gilgamesh?
Was there that much coherence to it?
I don't know. It was something my dad gave to me, and it was a bunch of Xeroxed stuff in it.
She rebuilt some kind of Sumerian instrument.
Specifically, she rebuilt the Great Lyre of Ur, okay. The Great Harp of Ur.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how she got the melodies.
No,
but
that seems spurious.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Although I've heard other recreation attempts. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's pretty cool. But this particular track was just like this one proverb sung twice, chanted. It was like chickpea flour is appropriate for every woman in the palace.
Well, advertising was in its infancy then.
So yeah,
jingles were still being worked out.
It wasn't quite Mad Men yet. So anyway.
Do you think it was written by business nuns?
Yeah, it could have been. It's possible. So anyway, we know of this proverb, like so much else about this ancientest of ancient cultures, because it is preserved in the dried clay tablets of cuneiform writing. And our big focus of this series is just how lifelike the ancient Mesopotamians are to us today, thanks to the preserving properties of cuneiform, the salt of ideas, the pickling jar of thoughts, that clay thing. And by the way, here's another food-related proverb for you.
Ooh.
One does not return borrowed bread.
Intentionally.
Unless one's had way too much of the Sumerian beer.
Yeah, maybe.
Which is funny, but for reasons that Nick and I know alone.
Yes.
Here's another one. His bread is finished. I want to see that on a Sumerian gangster movie.
I just see like Sumerian Paul Hollywood poking in the inside of a ancient loaf.
I actually know that reference.
Yeah, right. And then, of course, there are also proverbs that have nothing to do with food, but which are just plain cool. I suppose you might hear them around the dinner table, so here are two of my favorites of those. In the city where there are no dogs, the fox is the boss.
Well, I would argue that there are jackals around.
Here's another one.
Sorry.
The lives of the poor do not survive their deaths.
Well, I mean, genetically speaking...
And, that's the kind of thing that I could just imagine my dad telling me, but yeah. So anyway, for today's episode, I would actually like to begin with a quote from the venerable French scholar Jean Bottero, from which we get a lot of this. He's done studies and has a whole book on the cuisine of ancient Sumeria.
Hmm.
And he opines upon Sumerian cookery. Oh, that's funny. Microsoft Word auto-corrected it to Sumerican.
Samerica!
Fuck yeah!
Or maybe I just mistyped it, I don't know. Okay, so anyway, Joan Patero writes, "It is clear that their idea of good fare and taste was a million miles from our own. To give just a few examples, their devotion to fat, specifically mutton fat, with which they so generously basted all their dishes, their veritable mania for aliaceous plants, which, is that like garlicky?
Onions.
Onions. Yeah. Okay, yeah. In combination and as if reinforced, the perhaps secondary role that salt appears to have played in their diet, and other indications which, rightly or wrongly, de gustibus non est disputandum, I forgot to look that up.
Of taste, there is not whatever.
There's no disputing taste,
yeah.
I think.
That sounds right.
Seem to us deucedly off-putting. I shall therefore never amuse myself by trying out their recipes. And although I consider them to be the first inventors and practitioners of gastronomy and a high-class cuisine, I would not advise trying to incorporate their culinary tradition just as it stands into our own."
Now I want to know what French for deucedly is.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but that seems like a challenge to me.
Oh, dear.
I think it seemed like a challenge to you from what I'm seeing at that table behind you.
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis what he said about the dedication to mutton fat, what are those small sort of yellow-white cubes that I'm staring at from across the room?
That's cheese. That's cheese.
Thank God.
So we're taking up that dare today, because we have not only researched this cuisine, not only chosen the most eloquent descriptions of it for you, but we have indeed taken up the challenge, and today will truly be the Great Sumerian Bake-Off.
I get to be Sue.
We've actually prepared real Sumerian food and drink that we are going to sample right here on the show. And like I said, go to our website or Facebook to get pics. So this is going to be fun. We have nothing less than 7 courses of a Sumerian banquet before us. And on top of that, and this is my favorite part of all, Nick and Anna have home brewed actual Sumerian beer.
Nice.
Yeah. So remember that hymn to Ninkasi that we read in an earlier episode of this series? That was basically the recipe. And people have extracted from that how to do it. And Nick and Anna went to work, basically. And
Quick, it's starting to bubble again.
Oh, dear. That can't be good.
Yeah. So our sources for today come from recipes preserved from the 2nd and 3rd millennium BCE. And who knows how much older than that the recipes are before they're written down. I'm sure that was a long tradition. The 2nd and 3rd millennia spans the Sumerian and Akkadian eras. So, and the scholars I read like rarely specify which was which. So typically frustrating. We can't really tell if this was Sumerian, if it was Akkadian, or whatever, but Akkadians pretty much adopted Sumerian culture anyway, so who am I to complain? I get to eat Sumerian food, so.
You might be complaining as a result of that.
This is true.
most of our information actually comes from two main sources. One is vocabulary lists, just like you would get in high school Spanish class, where like Akkadian students would be taught Sumerian, like here's the Akkadian word, here's the Sumerian word, right? And also there are recipes, but that's with quotes, because these weren't like written by cooks for other cooks to cook with. You would probably learn that by oral tradition, but it was probably more like scribes who go into the kitchen to sort of like document what goes on in the royal kitchens and stuff and just kind of write things down, but not, they didn't do it in a way that's like, take exactly this much of this, and you know, they didn't tell us how to exactly cut something in or stir or whatever. As for where I'm personally getting this information, you can find references on our website, but it mostly comes from Jean Botero's The Oldest Cuisine, which is in his book Everyday Life of Ancient Mesopotamia, which I've also supplemented with tidbits from Karen Rhea Nemet Nejat's book Daily Life in Ancient Mesopotamia. Okay.
So what I'm picturing in my mind the whole time is this excavation of a whole bunch of Sumerian church basements and cuneiform tablets sort of comb-bound together with...
explaining how they made, like, pastries and really weak coffee.
Yeah.
numerous hymns to the goddess of the coffee urn.
Yes. Okay, so enough of that. Let's get to it. So, imagine if you will, that we have been invited to a banquet by a most generous host, a high-ranking bureaucrat of the ziggurat of our city. Let's just say it's Lagash, which was one of the powerful Sumerian cities in the southern part of the Fertile Crescent. Our host's hall, in which we dined, would likely be made of mud brick because trees were in short supply in Mesopotamia. It's not without reason that the Bible speaks in awed tones of the cedars of Lebanon, because they were rare and precious in that region, and timber was mostly only in the north, and tamarisk, poplars, willows, and a kind of pine would be the kind of trees you could obtain, or those cedars. Some even produced gums and resins used in perfumes and incense, by the way, in even mastic, which was an ancient chewing gum, and also a kind of aromatic resin.
Smells really good.
But to actually obtain any of that, you'd have to be super wealthy, and mostly you'd make stuff from mud brick, not wood.
Make your perfumes from mud brick.
Question, did mastic, did that come before the verb to masticate?
I think that the word mastic is probably actually derived from that, and not what the Sumerians or Akkadians would have called it. Hmm. So it's probably a Latin word from masticate. But yeah, good connection.
Yeah.
Servants of our host lead us into a chamber in which we politely enjoy conversation while waiting for the meal. And then our host appears. He has a shaved, bald head and long, black, well-oiled beard, a bare chest with a bit of a pot belly, and an extravagantly bulky sheepskin kaunakis, or kilt, that goes all the way down to his ankles. His high status garners him land appropriate to his rank, and that land provides him an income from its produce. He would lease the land out to tenant farmers, who generally get to keep two-thirds of the produce produced by the land, while paying him the remaining third as a rent, and it's this rent that allows him to invite us today to this sumptuous feast, along with many other guests, which you can imagine are around us.
So what do you see oil his beard with?
Good question.
Yeah.
Because you need olive trees for that, unless you're like smearing mutton grease into it.
I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Just naturally secrete a waxy resin at all times.
he is sharing his wealth with us today, presumably while regaling us, his captive audience, with lots of those like proverbs that we just heard.
I don't know. I've known some women in the palace check pewter flour wasn't appropriate for it. Woo! You know what I mean?
Preach.
Something that didn't go well for you. But I think he would probably want to get his audience a little bit slicked up for his many, many jokes that he would regale us with by serving us some beer to start off with. So why don't we start with that? Let's open up that beer.
All right.
Actual beer opening sounds.
There it is.
Well sealed. Right.
So we've got like a big tankard in the middle of us, and then we're going to drink from it with straws, which is how they actually would have done it. They would have done it from a big pot, kind of, and then you'd have this long straw with a filter on the end, which would filter out the bread bits and whatever else would fall in and just be floaty bits. into the beer. So who wants to go first?
Which one of us is most likely to backwash?
We've already tried it, so I think...
Do you want the honor, Rachel?
Yeah. Sure.
All right. You'll have to tell us what it tastes like.
We'll be terribly offended if you gag. Terribly offended.
It's apple juice.
Let's check this out.
I need pictures of this bending over a snorkel with a straw.
Yeah, it does. It tastes like kind of a bitter cider with a little bit of that kind of like almost like vinegary beer taste.
It's still a bit kombucha.
Yeah, it's like
it
sour
is
beer.
Kind of interesting. That's like sour beer. Okay, so how did you guys make this? Give us a little bit of a treat to what the process is.
Yeah, there's a little more bitter in there than I remember.
Mm-hmm. It didn't quite taste like that last good. Night.
I like it.
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Set the scene.
Okay. We were here. Brandon looks at us and he's like, "So, the Himden in Kasi."
And you're like, "I can do that."
Smash cut. Suddenly we're driving. basically, the nice thing is that people have reverse engineered sort of how to make this beer. But before we do anything, there is a caveat that, like, we didn't follow the Himden in Kasi, obviously. We just sort of, this is kind of jailbreak, sort of bashed together approximation of the beer.
But you did follow an online recipe from somebody who probably did follow the Himden in Kasi.
Yes, we
tried
did.
To sort of jury rig what we could do in our apartment kitchen.
Yeah, that's what I did with my dishes, recipe. Too.
The basis of it is you bake a bread, which
called
is
bapir.
The main source of fermentables, which is barley flour, malted barley flour, if you're making this into actual beer, and wheat flour and honey. Mix that with a whole bunch of water. Sort of mash it up so that it's fermentable, and then make date wine, which seems like it's sort of a yeast starter. The idea is you chop up dates and put water in them, and the natural yeast on the dates is supposed to ferment, and that's where you get the yeast that ferments the bapir in the water and it turns into beer.
Okay.
That's the idea of how it's supposed to work.
How did it actually work?
How it actually worked, since we don't have an all-grain brewing system, because you'd need to be able to boil 7 gallons of water at a time and know how and things like that, is we baked beer to put it in there to see if it affected the flavor. I mean, the bread. But with just regular barley flour, not anything malted or sprouted, because we don't know where to find that.
Yeah, frankly, the whole bread thing was just, for the look of it, it probably didn't actually affect anything in the brewing.
And otherwise made it with just malted grain extract, which is what you make beer from if you're a hack. It's just a syrup that comes in a bottle.
Okay.
You boil water with that. We crumbled a bunch of the barley bread in it. We did make the date wine to use as a yeast starter, but I didn't trust that the dates would ferment by themselves, so I added a little yeast.
That's pretty cool.
And that blew up and made an enormous mess in our kitchen.
So much.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
Turns out date fermentation is very, very vigorous.
Yeah. Yeah. Vigorous.
Nice. And no hops. That was a thing that came much, 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 much later in the late Middle Ages.
So we got that authenticity going.
Yeah, and we tried our best not to sanitize everything like you usually do in making beer. We did use
okay.
soap.
Okay.
But there's probably some wild funk from our kitchen in there.
Nick's expression is wonderful right now.
I'm going to have a little bit more.
Yeah, as a flavoring agent. In lieu of hops, this wasn't in the recipe, I don't think, but I've read references to both cardamom and coriander being used in ancient beer flavoring, so there's a little bit of that as well.
Interesting. Well, this is like a real treat. I'm super, super psyched about this. This is great. And I think we'll have plenty left over, so I think we should bring it to game night this week as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's 2 gallons of this, yeah. So...
Also, there was another thing that we did when we made the bapir for this. Bapir in the recipe is twice baked. The stuff that we brought today was only baked once because we're actually going to try to eat it. I don't know if that's a spoiler. But since the idea is you twice baked the bapir, sort of like biscotti, it was so hard that we were trying to break it apart with a hammer to get into small enough pieces to put into the beer. And that wasn't working great.
Don't work.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm really wow. curious as to how those
like
ancient
hard tech.
Yeah, like yeah, seriously.
Well, should I tell the beer secret?
Do you want to know the beer secret?
Oh yes, yes. A secret was promised before the episode.
I think,
oh. Yes.
I think for the interests of fairness, I should be drinking
slug before yeah. the beer secret comes out.
I'll be drinking while you tell it.
All right. So taking a nod from ancient Andean beer.
Andean, like from the Andes
from
Mountains,
the Andes,
South
yes.
America.
In case this made the malt more fermentable, and because it was the only way we could break up the damn stuff and fit it into our beer fermenting. Carboy.
Mm-hmm.
Since hammers don't work, the only way we could soften it was partially chewing it and spitting it into the big bucket.
Well, you.
Wow.
To be fair, you warned us it wasn't exactly sanitary.
It was boiled for an hour after that.
Oh,
it's perfectly sterile.
So it's sterile. Wait, so the hammer didn't break it, but your teeth did?
Yeah.
Combination of teeth and saliva, yeah. Wow.
I feel like a little chick fed by its
yes.
mother.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. That's a great beer secret. That's pretty cool. I don't know if cool is the right word. But...
this tasted like I was making out with Anna and Nick at the same time.
You can taste their saliva.
No. Like, what if that was a review of the beer?
Mm.
Would you accept it?
It's got, like, high Nick overtones with just a little bit of cardamom. Actually, he exclusively did the biting, so it's all Nick.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say exude cardamom, but
I think there's a little bit of Anna in there. Just in notes of Anna.
Well, I do secrete wild yeasts,
yeah.
So.
You do. And you baked the bop here.
Yeah, I did. I did put the bop here, so.
Yeah. Okay, well, very cool. Anyway, so that was the beer. Great. So now our host has us, you know, a little, like, you know, kind of loosey-goosey, ready to enjoy his culinary delights. So exactly what would happen next in a banquet like this is a little bit of a mystery. Somehow out of about 500,000 tablets that we've recovered so far, we haven't recovered a single account of an actual meal or banquet.
Huh.
Yeah.
So how are we sitting, I'm wondering? I'm
yeah.
curious about that, too.
That I actually do have some hints of historicity about.
Like, are we
because
reclining
there are...
like a Greek symposium? Or
yeah, good question.
Tables, or...
So there are some... plaques, basically, like terracotta mm-hmm. plaques recovered by archaeologists that I've seen where it shows them sitting on low benches.
Huh.
And then they've got something in between them, like presumably where the platter of food goes.
Right.
And then they would kind of share the communal platter and eat from it. I don't know if that's meant to be typical of everybody. I only know of two that I found. One of them was meant to be prisoners of war
mm.
eating.
Huh.
So that could not be typical. And the other one, if I remember right, I think was the gods. So, again, might not be typical, but who knows?
Could be gods, could be Elamites.
Fucking Elamites.
Well, I think the prisoners of war might have been actually Elamites, yeah.
A tradition of the podcast we need to induct you into is whenever the term Elamite comes up, everyone must say in chorus,
fucking Elamites!
Yeah.
What's an Elamite?
They were the people that were to the... east of Sumerian. They're constant rivals and enemies, yeah.
It's not trilobite. Okay.
No, trilobites went extinct around the Permian, if memory serves. And
yeah. Elamites went extinct...
around the Permian.
Yeah.
Which is before they came around. It's complicated.
So anyway, so Botero speculates that they may not have actually had a dedicated dining room for eating, but could have just eaten anywhere and had the dishes brought to them, wherever they were in the house. Something we do know is that Sumerians, on average, ate two meals a day, although the wealthy may have doubled this with some lighter meals in between there. The average day saw two meals, one in the morning and one in the evening, and the latter was probably their main meal, and it was designated with kinsig in Sumerian, which is the same word as twilight, so we're going to have our twilight at this banquet.
All right.
Our bread is finished.
Oh, no.
Nice. We also know something of Sumerian table manners. I really like this one.
Uh-oh.
So I read a reference that you bow according to the number of dishes served to you. So there's a little bit of interpretation as to what exactly that means, but I would interpret that as the first dish you bow once, the second dish you bow twice,
ah.
and so on. So
wow, if you get a cheese tray or a dessert cart, this gets weird.
Yeah. I also found that the person to whom we would owe thanks for this meal, who works in the kitchen, is called in Sumerian, or actually I think this might be Akkadian, actually, the Muhaldim, or embellisher.
Ooh.
And we don't know exactly what that role is, but with a name like that, you can just imagine.
Right? That sounds a little more Semitic.
Yeah, I think after a while, I started to pick up on the differences in how they sound. So that one sounds more Akkadian. Yeah. So, but with a guy like that and a name like that for his job, you can just imagine that this is significantly more than just subsistence food that we're eating. Like, this is cuisine.
The person who drizzles all the little lattice patterns. Yeah, someone needs
to mutton fat on that.
Yeah, then just a little bit of that green puree on the side.
Yeah. In fact, the Mesopotamians actually bragged of their culinary abilities, contrasting it with the simple fare eaten by the desert nomads, who they considered to be barbarians.
Was there a term?
I don't know if there was a term that equals to barbarians. But anyway, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the ways that the wild man Enkidu is tamed is actually by educating him in the delights of well-prepared food.
And sex.
That too. So, at this point in the banquet, the servants begin to file in with the platters of our dishes and start to, you know, put it in between the groups of people. We're like one of several groups of guests, we'll say. And so we would have a platter. Each course would be put in, like, in the center of us, and we would eat together. So let's go to that now. Our first dish comes, again, courtesy of Nick and Anna, and that is a kind of bread, in this case, bapir, the same bread that you use to make the beer. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to dole it out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There you are. And let's take a bite. It is quite hard. There's a little bit of sweetness to it.
That's
There's a lot of honey in here.
It looks like, so the loaf itself looks like a big discus. And it's about as heavy as a discus. It's a brown, like, bready color, and it's quite dense. But it's not as dense as hardtack. It doesn't look like a big cracker like hardtack.
For the record, we didn't see any evidence that anybody would have actually been eating a bread like this either. You know, it is pretty much just a starter for beer. And I believe there was some speculation that instead of people inventing bread first and then beer, it might have been the other way around. I think we covered that before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which you can sort of, tasting this, you can sort of see maybe that does seem like a logical progression.
Well, they had lots of other kinds of bread, though.
Mm-hmm.
Some 300 varieties of bread are known. Mm. Differentiated by materials. It would be differentiated by using this or that kind of flour, leavened or not. I think most of it was unleavened, but apparently, according to Botero, there are some that were leavened, which just means made with yeast, right?
Mm-hmm. So that rises. They had yeast
if they're brewing. Yeah, mm-hmm.
This is unleavened.
With oil, with milk or beer, sweet, flavored with this or that spice, containing such and such fruits, and so on. It was also differentiated by shape. Every size from, quote, very big to, quote, minuscule, and every kind of thickness and length, every sort of shape, including humorously in the shape of a head, ear, a heart, or even a woman's breast. So there were all those varieties of bread.
No dick bread.
I'm sure. Maybe it just was not mentioned, but I'm sure there probably was.
The cuneiform tablet records have not yet been recovered.
Yeah.
I like this, though.
It's actually not that bad. Mm-hmm. The honey you can taste, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like you dip it in coffee, then it's a little more tolerable.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, you could imagine that. Mm-hmm. Or dipping it in the beer itself, I bet. Mm. Yeah. This is barley bread, and a lot of it was. Barley was the staple crop of Mesopotamia and the key to their diet. Also a key ingredient in the beer, which you've already heard. Barley was actually more hardy in arid and saline conditions than wheat was, so it became the staple because the soil in Mesopotamia was kind of like that. They also had millet, a little less frequent, and later in Persian times, rice was introduced. Agriculture in Mesopotamia would be directed by urban leadership including intensive use of the ground by planting more frequently, mixing crops, and applying fertilizer. So already at that time, they were already, you know, developing some significantly advanced agricultural techniques. You would also be expand the area of land used for agriculture at the direction of the urban leadership and introduce new labor sources and strategies, which I have to read that as probably meaning getting slaves from. Exactly. Yeah. Also, they had a complicated system of irrigation canals, and the Mesopotamian irrigation canals could be as much as 120 plus meters wide.
Whoa.
No wonder the settler units always take so long.
That's like
on
a
that.
Freaking river. Hmm. I don't understand how that could actually be accurate, but that is what I read.
Dang.
But it could be as little as 1 meter wide at its narrowest, and it would use gravity to direct the waters and to get the water where it needed and store it where it needed, where it was needed, and drain it where it was no longer needed and keep it from getting to where it was never needed. They used a pretty complicated system of like outlets and sluices and stuff and regulators made of reeds or baked brick and bitumen to sort of catch the mainstream and raise the water to the appropriate level. Almost sounds to me like a dam, mm-hmm. kind of. So pretty interesting, complex technology going on. Made of levees and quay walls made of bricks and things and to protect against erosion. And actually, construction and maintenance of the canals was considered an important and pious duty of the kings. Hmm. And cleaning and dredging under local authority is a little less important than the king. salinization of the soil was actually a problem as early as 2000 BCE, which I always find interesting. You always think of like ancient peoples as being so in tune with nature and everything. No. Well,
also, all the southern Sumerian cities were in big salt marsh, aren't they? That's like what southern Iraq is now.
Maybe. But my question, and I don't know the answer, my question is, how do they get salty? Do they get salty as a result of intensive agriculture, not knowing how to do it right?
Or it's the longest there's been intensive agriculture anywhere on Earth.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Anyway, all right. I think it's time that we should go on to our next dish. So, the next dish that we have that is brought out by the serpents... that is brought out by the servants.
You should leave that in. It's just wonderful picture.
The next dish that is brought out by the servants is honeyed dates with sheep's milk cheese.
Hmm.
Yes. Oh. So you can use your forks. They wouldn't have had eating implements. They'd probably just use, you know, whatever. Fingers.
These have pits in them?
No pits.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do I just do like a double thing?
Sure, whatever you want.
I'll go like that.
Ah, dates. The fruit that looks like cicadas.
They absolutely did.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And this is not, I didn't try super hard with this one. I basically just got dates and cheese from the co-op, and then I put some honey on the dates.
So. So you're the arranger, and you're one of the most highly revered people in the kitchen.
Yeah. This is actually one of my most co-op-y moments of my life. And I went to the co-op and I was like asking for all these weird things. And the guy's like, what are you making? I'm like, some ancient Sumerian recipes. And he's like, cool, man.
Did you use our expensive honey?
I don't know which one is our expensive honey. Maybe I should know that.
It's the one in the jar.
No.
Oh, good.
For what it's
okay.
worth, the bop here has very expensive honey. Also from the same, probably the same co-op.
Yeah, and the barley flour. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No one gave us funny looks about that.
No.
It's kind of good cheese.
Not even when we were dropping it down the sides.
I don't think the cheese is...
Yeah, the cheese didn't get it.
Break out the Ritz
crackers. Sorry. I kept it in my hand. That's
you did.
Kind of, no.
What a bad serpent.
I'm not bowing to you.
Oh, yes, we should be.
Oh, yeah.
Twice now.
Let's bow twice, yes? All right. Anybody want any more? Okay.
Wow, this is nice cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Dang.
It's mild for goat flavor. Right, it's goat flavor, right?
Sheep's milk.
Oh, sheep. Okay.
So close, but yeah. Okay, so a little bit about this stuff. Honey from bees, they did have, but it was rare and expensive. Beeswax was used for medicine and for writing boards sometimes that would be easy to erase.
Mm-hmm. But dry erase.
They were, exactly. It was dry and it was erased. It would be quite expensive, I imagine, though. As far as the dates, every part of the date palm was used. The dates were used as a sweetener. It could be preserved and stored. And the palm sprout was actually used like celery in cooking.
Hmm.
I didn't find any specific recipes calling for palm sprout, but apparently it was, according to scholars that I read anyway. Alcohol was made from the fruit. You guys made the date wine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also artificial fertilization was practiced, according to my notes. I don't remember the details on that part. I think it means fertilization of the date plants, if I remember right. Hmm. So,
well, like hand pollinating.
I think maybe.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. The date palms would have been interplanted with lower fruit trees like apple trees and pomegranate trees. Other fruit that they would cultivate would be figs, pears, a type of plum. And beneath the fruit trees, within the shade of the trees, is where you would have your vegetable garden. And for vegetables, they would grow things like onions, garlic, leeks, turnips, lettuce, cucumbers, which they might serve raw or serve boiled.
What happens to a cucumber when you boil it? Seems like it would just sort of...
You can't do that.
You'll find out, actually.
No, it's not possible. Nature rebels.
Also, gardening in the shade of trees, and just, you know, on a tangent, the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon was pretty late in the timeline, built by Nebuchadnezzar II, which would have been 604 to 562 BCE.
So Neo-Babylon.
To please his wife. Yeah, so.
See, I just want a pergola.
Also, as far as the cheese, there were 18 to 20 different varieties of cheese known. Sheep's milk cheese, spicy cheeses, cream cheeses, fresh cheeses, flavored cheeses, sweetened cheeses, sharp cheeses. For milk products, you would have yogurt, you'd have cheese, you'd have ghee, which is like Indian butter, clarified butter.
Clarified butter, yeah.
Yeah. Milk was actually not as popular as a drink because it spoiled rapidly in a hot climate like that, but it was used as medicine, interestingly. I would imagine my first guess would be for upset stomach. Or maybe, actually... I don't know. Maybe that
makes some sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it does settle in.
Yeah. Unless you're lactose intolerant, in which case it does the opposite. All right, you guys ready for our next one?
Yes.
Okay.
Surprised by the apples and the plums. I always think of that as being more cool weather.
Yeah, interesting, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so for our next one, let's bow three times.
Yes.
One, two, three.
We can tell Brandon, who lived in Japan, is a very efficient bower
compared to the rest of us. Yeah, he's got to stand to a science.
All right, so this one, mercifully, I'm not making you eat what they actually would have served.
Oh, that's a great prelude.
Because what they actually would have served for this would be roasted locusts in fish sauce.
Ooh.
Instead, I just did almonds instead of the locusts.
And I thought you were going to go shrimp.
Hey, yeah. Arthropods.
Are shrimps related to locusts?
They're arthropods.
Yeah, they're segmented in chitinous.
Yeah, okay, well.
I'll take almonds. I will totally take almonds.
Likewise. And Nick doesn't eat shrimp.
No, I don't eat locusts either.
But... Well, you say that.
So anyway, I've added a little bit of soy sauce and some sambal to this to make it a little bit more like an Asian kind of spicy fish sauce. They did have spices here, but I could never find what kind of spices they would have. So anyway, just almonds kind of in the sauce. So... This is the one where
this is fish sauce, right?
You're allowed to spit it out if you don't like it.
So for actual authenticity, I would hope you just take a can of anchovies, leave that sitting out in the sun until it had completely pureed.
Well, that would be like the Roman garum, right. Which this reminds me of. And I wonder if
And then
Roman...
just add a bunch of cumin.
Yeah, yeah.
Put that on shrimp.
I do wonder if Roman garum actually long way back derives from something like this fish sauce.
Wouldn't surprise me at all.
I don't taste
the
fish sauce at all.
I taste a little. Mostly soy sauce. Oh, it kind of comes through after you chew it for a bit.
Oh, yeah.
But oh, yeah.
The smell has a little bit of that pungency. But not too bad.
My fingers smell.
Oh, yeah.
Crunchy like I'd expect the locust to be.
Mm-hmm. So, roasted locusts in fish sauce was actually an Assyrian luxury food. It plagued fields, so you might as well eat it as well, I guess. I don't know how exactly it was prepared, but I would guess roasted. And then as for our condiment, there was a kind of fish brine called shiku, which sounds to me, like I said, like that Roman garum. As far as spicy seeds that they would have used, it would have included seeds from cress, mustard, cumin, coriander. They also had linseed for oil. Maybe that's your answer to what they would use for their beards.
You could slowly varnish your insides.
I'm just seeing a bunch of, like at a convenience store, all these different flavors of locusts. There's honey mustard locusts,
linseed locusts. Like those cashews at the co-op.
Yeah, exactly. Curry
barbecue
locusts.
Barbecue locusts, yeah. They did have olive trees in the foothills, mainly in the north, for olive oil. Okay, are you ready now to move on? We've gotten rid of our appetizers here. Mm-hmm. Now we're going on to the meat dishes. Ooh. So kind of like phase two of our banquet. So four bows. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, for the next two courses, actually the next three, we have meat. So a little bit about meat in ancient Mesopotamia. Sheep was used mainly for milk products, more than for meat. Although not exclusively, we're going to have a little bit today. Meat was used for offerings, for divination, for wedding gifts, and presents to gain access to the king. You'd give a gift to the king and he'd give you an audience or whatever.
So if you have like a priest king sitting up in a ziggurat, it seems like there's kind of almost a crossover with animal sacrifice there.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
You burn a meat offering to gain access to the gods. You do the same thing to the king that's up in...
And that's how a lot of religious things went, is like basically on analogy to how humans do it, that's how we should do it with the gods.
What?
You know?
Wondering, and vice versa. The opposite.
Well, yeah,
you
I mean...
burn meat to...
It's a chicken or the egg kind of thing. Yeah. So, speaking of animal sacrifice, the animal would have to be blemish and disease-free, sometimes white. Any domestic animal could be used for sacrifice, but sheep was especially used for divination by entrails. Animal fattener. There was a specialist called an animal fattener who gradually increased the sheep's rations to improve the flavor and the fat content. And sheep and goats were called small cattle. And they were kept in large flocks owned by a state, temple, or private owners and branded with the owner's mark.
So just like a cow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I imagine so.
You ever seen somebody try to wrestle them at the state fair?
Those are not happy brands.
Ever.
Temple brands would be, so the sheep that were branded, that were owned by the temple, would be branded with the symbol of the god. So a spade was the symbol for Marduk, a star for Ishtar, and so on. It would typically be tended by a family member or given to a shepherd who sort of subcontracts to other shepherd boys. And your flock could be as small as 4 and as large as 200. And you also would be assisted by dogs to protect from lions, which is now extinct in that region. And also to protect from wolves, which would typically cull about 10% of the flock.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
You hear about the wolves, but lion attacks never make it into so much, you know, you call it pastoral poetry. Except for the Psalms, I suppose, actually.
Yeah, there's kind of a lot in that.
Which, written by a shepherd boy, supposedly, so never mind, I eat my words.
Okay, you guys ready?
Like sheep.
All right, so we start off light. So dish number 4 is called Zukanda. And this is... It's actually, like, glossed as to where it comes from. This is specifically an Elamite broth.
Fucking Elamites!
Fucking Elamites! I don't
All
know right. if I can eat this.
Yeah.
Ugh. So this is the sound of broth sloshing around. It's so relaxing. Looks like something you could get at the cafeteria at IKEA, except for the metric ton of grease on the top.
Okay, so this, this broth... it has mutton in it for the meat part of it. It has dill for seasoning. It has leeks and onions. Actually, just leeks in this one. And it also has coriander, I believe. And what else is in there? Fat. Like the guy said, lots of fat was used for it.
Well...
I don't mind it.
Kind of like it. Glad we ate something pretty fibrous before.
Yeah.
So this one we actually have a recipe for. This is straight from the actual cuneiform tablet. So it says, meat is used. Prepare water, add fat, dill, Suhutinu. I didn't know what that was, so I couldn't use it.
Huh.
Coriander, leek, and garlic, bound with blood. I left out the blood part. A corresponding amount of kisimu. Again, we don't know what that is. These are both Sumerian terms, so I didn't use it. And more garlic. So there's plenty of garlic in here. This is actually
always a good thing.
Twice in the same.
Oh yeah, the dill is nice.
Like a two-line recipe. Yeah. They mentioned it twice already. So
I'm really digging this.
I'm actually shocked at the amount of apprehension I have over all this. I have like a permanent scowl on my face. I'm just very skeptical.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm shocked that you don't have more apprehension.
It just looks like a liquid that would come from Mars. Not the swirly fat. Like I'm eating mercury or something.
Mars? Eating mercury?
I don't know. Like
Mars is full of mutton grease.
That's in the canals of Mars.
Just looks otherworldly. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I get it, because the grease pattern's on the top.
Yeah,
but not your typical like oil, like in a circle. This is just like all of it.
No, it looks like animal fat. Not like vegetable. Well, yeah, but I mean, it doesn't look like...
Okay.
But it's good.
The dill is good, though.
I really added to it a lot.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that added to the flavor a lot.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the flavor is really nice.
Yeah, I like that. I would make this and eat it.
The greasiness is a little much for me.
Yeah.
I had no idea how much lard to put in there, so...
Oh, lard.
Well, yeah, it's going to get painful later. Lard is fat. Right now, it's great.
All right. You ready for our next one?
We are.
Now, the next two dishes are really where I focused most of my attention. I went all out with these ones. So the next dish, let's bow five times. One, two, three, four, five.
I'm going to hit the mic.
Yeah, I did.
This is cucumbered mutton.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And this is a delicate preparation for the meat of sacrificed animals. So first I'm going to say the actual recipe, and then I'll give you it to taste it.
I am pretty stoked for this one.
So this says, take some fennel, watercress, dodder, and Botero glosses that as the Arabic word kuchut, but I went to Haluland Delhi and nobody there even had any idea what kuchut could be.
Huh.
And when I looked up dodder on the internet, that was like the kind of witch's hair that like kind of parasitically hangs from tree branches and stuff, so I couldn't figure out what that was supposed to be. Okay, so take some fennel, watercress, dodder, and cumin, all in seeds roasted. I did as many as I could get in seeds. The rest is actually the part of the plant. Bring 6 liters of water to the boil, previously flavored by infusion with raw mustard. Add 15 grams of cucumber. Cook until reduced to 1 liter, from 6 liters to 1 liter. I didn't manage it to cook down that much, but I got it to cook down at least half.
That'd make your gas bill go up.
Strain, add meat of sacrificed animal to be cooked.
So this really is show-off food, because if you're basically just burning cow dung for fuel, and you don't have...
I know, that's what I was thinking. It's in a place where fuel's scarce and you don't have a lot of wood, and you're reducing 5 liters of water.
Yeah.
All right. All right. So the recipe said to use all those things and then strain and then add the meat, which I did, but there was just... the broth that it went in was so watery still that I like added a lot of stuff back in there just to give it some kind of flavor.
Is that because you cooked it with a lid on?
Mm-mm. No, it was because it was strained and not enough of the flavor actually transferred to the broth itself. Or maybe I didn't use enough of the spices. I don't know.
It's not very salty.
No.
Mm-mm.
Is it very cucumbery?
I guess the recipe didn't mention seasoning with salt, did it?
No, and Botero mentioned that they didn't really use very much salt for cooking. So to me, this tastes like you would have a really pretty refined palate. Because especially if you did it the way the recipe said, with straining everything out and then just using just that very like specially delicate broth to cook the meat in, the amount of flavor would be so subtle that I wonder if they were just like really into those very, very subtle flavors.
If you think you're getting flavor out of a boiled cucumber.
Well, actually, it gives it a really interesting, fresh flavor.
It's just, it's not...
Yeah.
something that someone with our palate would ever think of as a flavor ingredient.
Right.
I gotta say, it tastes kind of fresh.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
In a way that
better than the opposite.
Out of all the things you cooked, I think, so when I'm tasting the mutton, or mm-hmm. the lamb here,
yeah.
that flavor is what I smelled in the kitchen this whole morning.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I smelled it a little kind of, you know, it's nice. Mm-hmm. But it's I like lamb.
Aromatic.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, you ready for the next one? Dish number 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I'm sorry, I'm holding it up with the bowing.
Yeah.
We have to bow at angles so we don't hit the mics.
True.
So this one is called minted francolin. And a francolin, I looked up, is a kind of bird that they had. It's kind of like a pheasant.
Mm.
Of course, where the hell are you going to find a francolin? So I just used chicken. They didn't have chicken until very late, like the 1000 BCE and later, mainly during like the Persian and Hellenistic periods.
That still seems early to me.
But before that, But before that, they did have like something like this.
Sure.
Francolin. I suppose I could have asked like one of my hunter relatives to hunt me a pheasant, but I don't know if that's even legal at this time of year. But that also would require planning. So
that's true.
Anyway, I use chicken. Here is the recipe. And this is the longest recipe that I'm citing today. Split the birds open, clean well with cold water, and assemble in a cauldron to sear them. Remove from the fire and clean well again with cold water. Sprinkle with vinegar and rub all over crushed mint and salt.
So finally there is some salt.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Put beer in a clean cauldron and add fat. Clean the birds well with cold water and assemble all the ingredients in the cauldron. When the cauldron is hot, remove from the fire, sprinkle with vinegar, and pat with mint and salt.
So you rub mint and salt on it.
Mm-hmm.
You clean it off with cold water. Then you add more mint and salt.
I don't know why, and it didn't really work very well for me. I managed to find my own way to get the mint and salt on there, but...
Julia Child could explain it to us.
And then the recipe continues. Assemble the ingredients in a pot with water, a piece of fat from which the gristle has been removed, a carefully measured amount of vinegar, and, as desired, pieces of aromatic wood soaked in beer and stripped rue leaves. I left out the wood and the rue leaves because couldn't get those.
No rue leaves.
When it comes to a boil, add samidu, which is some kind of spicy plant, but I don't think we know what. Leek and garlic mashed with onion. Put the birds in this broth and cook. So, let's... give it a try.
Are there any recipes for Sumerian beer can chicken?
I think that might be what this is.
I'm assuming it'd be a freshly killed chicken that they would have used.
They would have used it, yeah.
Or Franklin.
Yeah.
Woo!
Was that a good woo?
I don't know.
It's a well-cooked chicken breast. Props for that.
The liquid is interesting.
It's a great statement, and very diplomatic. The liquid is interesting.
Well, that's different. Actually, it's really nice.
Listeners who are not from Minnesota, when we say something tastes different, that means it's not good.
I like it. Oh, wow.
Hey, no, I actually like this a lot.
Mmm. Mmm.
Try the broth part by itself.
Yeah, I'm eating all this.
Yeah, I think I'm
too. It's a unique flavor.
Yeah, it is a unique flavor. Can you taste the bitterness in the broth?
Mm-hmm.
That's because this was beer.
Oh,
there's beer for the base of it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. There's beer and onions, well, a lot of the other stuff that it said. And then for the trying to get the salt and mint on there, I ended up like slicing into the breast and stuffing it, basically, with mint and salt.
Nice. Also not dissimilar from something you could get at the Holy Land.
I was thinking that.
Yeah, I actually kind of really like this one.
Yeah, I do too.
It has like a grape leaves taste.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we might need this recipe.
I'll send you the tablet. So other birds that they would eat would include geese and ducks, raised as early as the 3rd millennium BCE. And they would even keep bird pets, believe it or not.
Hmm.
Including Ibis, ooh, which, or Ibis, I don't know how to say it, but I-B-I-S, mm-hmm, that's the one that, like, I think, was it Thoth? Thoth? Right? The Egyptian god so. Thoth has an ibis head, kind of like a long beak, like, looks like a waterfowl, something that would fish with that long beak. So, for pets, ibis, crane, heron, and pelican. And the pelicans supposedly were even trained for fishing.
Like, oh, cormorants. Like that.
Huh.
And speaking of fishing, they would fish by nets, spears, or baskets. Carp was the most common fish that they ate, but 50 different species of fish are mentioned. They'd be preserved with salt and sometimes spices. It says species here. I love autocorrect. Also, turtles and turtle eggs would be eaten.
Huh.
But strangely, after the old Babylonian period, fishing is rarely mentioned. And in the Neo-Babylonian period in Uruk, the word for fisherman comes to mean criminal.
Oh.
So.
So
I wonder if that's a geography thing.
Maybe, yes. Because
it seems like there'd be more fish again south in the old Sumerian lands.
Yeah, but all those cities were all equally on a river.
True.
And, you know, if you want to go toward seacoast, that. I mean, there's only, like, one tiny little area that would have that.
And also, it seems like usually the Sumerian stuff was pretty prestige, not...
True. Yeah.
Maybe after Dagon rose to power, he didn't want you messing with his peeps.
This does taste like something you guys would make, and you would come over and be like, oh, that's interesting.
This tastes like Rachel Diplomacy.
It tastes like something you would get at, like, this fancy restaurant that you're only able to be there because, like, your boss is paying for it or something.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so anyway, our last dish is something of a dessert. At least that's how I interpreted it, so that's how I put it here. Also, I have no idea if all these would have been come out, like, brought out one by one, like, as a seven-course meal like we're used to. Totally an inference on my part. Anyway, whatever. Dish seven. Seven bowels. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven.
Core workout here.
Yeah. and this is something called Ninda Ideya. And I think that sounds Sumerian to me.
That sounds more Sumerian. Yeah.
It is some kind of cake. The name comes from the root for to mix or to stir. And it is presented in the cuneiform text as a kind of bread. But all we have is a list of ingredients, which tantalizes us with what this actually might be.
Oh my god, it's the technical.
Yeah?
What's the technical? Oh, is that from Bake Off?
Yes. The Great British Bake Off, where they don't actually tell them what to do.
Oh no, okay. Alright, well you see if I pass or not. I don't know if I get voted off the island or not. I've never actually watched a Bake Off episode.
Put your cake on the Gingham Altar.
Okay. So here's the list of here's the list of ingredients. This is all we get. Flour, sometimes water, milk, or beer, but preferably oil or butter for moistening. Dates or other dried fruits, for example, grapes, figs, or apples. Different kinds of pine kernel for the filling.
Oh.
And then for seasoning, nigella, which I guess is black onion seed, and I did find that at Holy Land,
yeah,
you could only get it this big thing for like $6. So like, I'll never use that again. And I've cooked with it before, and it doesn't really add much to the flavor. So just imagine some black seeds on it. Cumin, coriander, and garlic.
Sounds like the everything bagel.
So
yeah, it does.
Good one. Yeah. So it's like a sweet fruity bread, but with cumin, coriander, and garlic.
So it's like if the everything bagel had blueberries and raisins in it.
Oh. It really was everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes honey would be added. Mixing or stirring would be done in a cooking pot.
So you slather as much on as I know. A mix of honey, walnut, and smoked salmon cream cheese.
Exactly.
Making sure just to get a little of barbecue sriracha in there.
Yeah. So again, I don't know if they had any such concept as dessert, but this sounds like a dessert to me, so let's do it now. All right.
Ooh, pre-sliced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It looks sort of like that Slovenian petitza.
Yeah.
A little, I guess it does on the inside. Yeah. Maybe that's the apples.
Yeah,
it's roll in the middle.
Did you put pine nuts in it?
He's always poking at it. Yeah. Everything is
yes,
raw.
Pine nuts. There's pine nuts. That's the best I could do for pine kernels.
Don't eat this, Mary.
Same thing, I'm assuming, right? That's what I would think, but who knows?
Hmm. Hmm. Digging it so far.
Yeah.
I've traced the lineage of the everything bagel back to this. I like how the pine nuts just fall out.
Mm-hmm. I've never had pine nuts before. They were fucking expensive.
What's going on with the middle? It's very, like, it's not Play-Doh-y, but it's not, like, pull-apart bread. It's like a...
I know.
What can we describe that to listeners?
So, yeah, so it's... Well, it's like Play-Doh, isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
I mean, it's...
A bit raw.
So there's no,
Undercooked.
So there's no eggs in it. Because they didn't really use eggs in cooking, it seemed. And so that it doesn't make it, like, fluffy. I think that's what eggs add to the bread, right? They get a little fluffy.
The binding agent, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
And there's no kind of leaven, right? It's not, obviously, right. Not baking powder or baking soda. It's just, also not yeast.
I used flour, soy milk, and oil.
Yeah.
So I had no idea how to make it or what the, you know, proportions would be.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's pretty amiable.
The outside's very attractive. It's mm-hmm. like a mm-hmm. loaf with a bunch of things.
The presentation is good, but the flavors.
Yes. I like the corn, the pine nuts in it, though.
Yeah.
That's good.
Those are nice.
And cranberries, you said?
Dates.
Dates.
Oh, I use dates and apples in it.
Mm-hmm. I think the Nigella wouldn't really add anything to it.
Yeah. Mm. I haven't found a date yet, but...
I think I got a chunk of one on the side.
Now, I backed way off on the cumin and the coriander for obvious reasons, and the garlic, but I think it could have... I don't taste it at all, so I think it could have added more.
I've got a bunch.
You got some?
Not so much the core. I just bit into a big chunk of cumin.
Okay.
It's really kind
of
nice.
Wait, are you one of the people that say cumin?
Instead of...
Cumin. We discovered this as both... You can actually say both ways.
Hmm. Well, good.
I actually don't know. I thought I would have said cumin. Maybe I could say cumin. What do I say?
I don't know.
What? You knew me.
It's all been a lie.
I know someone that says cumin, and I was like, what?
Anyway, about half of that is enough for me.
Yeah, it's like a fruitcake. But
yeah,
not really
it's pretty dense.
And yeah, like
my first couple bites were really garlicky.
Mm.
It seems like there are places where.
Mm.
Then it was really just apples and soy milk and pine nuts, and then I got a big bite of cumin.
All right, there it is. That is our Sumerian banquet. 7 courses, accompanied by a great big jug of Sumerian barley beer. That's still probably my favorite part, actually. I've been sucking on that the whole time through here.
Let the record also state, Brandon, a couple weeks ago, made a traditional Slovenian dish with baked apples of his ancestry called petica.
Yep.
Looked a lot like the Sumerian cake.
Yeah.
It might have tasted like it if you took away some of the sugar and added cumin and garlic.
I might have just done like a 3-card Monty kind of slip you the petica kind of thing with this one. I don't know. Anyway, a little bit about Sumerian beer before we end. So the varieties of beer were many that were known, including white beer, russet beer, light beer, dark beer, cloudy beer, sweetened with honey beer, flavored with many aromatics beer, sometimes diluted but often strong. The size of Sumerian parties was actually measured not in the number of guests, but by the amount of beer poured.
I thought that was for the quality of Sumerian parties.
That makes sense. And to really finish this out, I have for you a divine drinking game to conclude our episode here. So this comes from like a Sumerian myth. So the gods, after becoming merry, engage in a game. And the game is to find uses for quote-unquote flawed humans. And so it's like they give you a challenge, and you have to figure out what they're good for. Like, it's like, what's their role in society would be the use, quote-unquote. So, for example, I have 3 examples. One is a blind person, another is a hermaphrodite, and another is a barren woman.
Mm.
Any ideas for the uses that you could come up with for those?
So under what circumstances do we drink and which ones don't we?
I didn't think it was quite like that. I think they just did
so
it
just
while they were
when
drinking.
You're drunk.
Yeah,
okay.
I think so. Yeah.
I mean,
where do we all vote? Whether it's a good enough use and if it's not, you have to take a drink.
People can hold doors open. They can all do that.
I hear that hermaphrodites can both tell the future and figure out whether the male or the female has more pleasure in orgasm.
That's Greek.
Hmm. Interesting.
But, same general broad culture area.
Anyway, that was just straight up gender swapping.
So you want to hear what the gods came up with?
So, what? Do we have anything for barren women yet?
Rule in the world.
What about business nuns? Would they make good business nuns?
Oh, yeah.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any theories on this, Rachel?
Well, does barren mean, like, you can't have children, or you just don't have any at the moment?
Can't.
Can't, yeah.
Like, infertile.
Well, I can see your notes, so I will not comment.
Okay. Does a bunch of gods getting drunk and then presumably, in this eschatology, did they actually, like, create humans?
Hmm.
Or did humans just sort of exist independently of gods?
Not as part of this myth.
Oh.
I mean, they did, but not as part of this myth.
Because it's sort of weird that a bunch of supposedly omnipotent beings with powers of creation are suddenly like, yeah, a bunch of the stuff we made is all posed up and broken. What good is it?
Like, what are we going to do with it?
Are we apologizing for ourselves?
I think there was actually a myth, though, that explains why they didn't get it all right. I don't remember what it was, but...
Because they drink.
Yeah, maybe.
Exactly.
So anyway...
They probably all get dipped in fish sauce.
Yeah.
Oh, God. So, according to this, the blind people are good as musicians and bards.
Okay, that's kind of a...
Checks out.
Yeah, universal standard.
Not so surprising. Hermaphrodites, good for ranks of homosexuals and transvestites, which were popular at the time, believe it or not. So that was apparently enough of a role for them, like, you have a function in society as a homosexual and a transvestite?
Professional gay.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much. They did have prostitutes that were homosexuals.
Is it like
and
chick with a dick thing that's a universal fetish going back to...
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
They were around, and they were prostitutes and other things, so...
But I wanted to be an accountant. No.
And finally, barren women, good for being prostitutes.
But I wanted to be an accountant.
Anyway.
So the gods are assholes when they drink.
Okay. For our final piece de resistance here, I have a little excerpt from a Sumerian drinking song. You have to imagine us, like, drinking this in a very, like, merry and rosy tune.
Fucking Elamites!
Fucking Elamites!
Okay, so it goes, I will summon brewers and cupbearers to serve us floods of beer and keep it passing round. What pleasure, what delight, blissfully to take it in. To sing jubilantly of this noble liquor, our hearts enchanted and our souls radiant.
Rachel, bust out the synth.
Yeah,
synth solo.
All right, so I think that's enough for this episode. Thank you, everybody. I didn't really do so well. That was Nick's attempt at ringing the gong here in my room to finish us out. Anyway, I expect all of you homebrewers out there to have your vats up and going by next week. Send us samples in the mail, but failing that, why not just support the show in other ways, such as on Patreon, where you can get great perks, like your portrait drawn in the time period and culture of your choosing. That's right, you too can be a flouncy skirted scribe with a stylish stylus, or an embellisher. You could draw you as an embellisher.
God, I want to contribute again, so I can be a flouncy skirted scribe with a
technically,
stylish stylus.
Technically, we still have one pending. So
okay,
doping,
yeah.
So.
True, you can cash it in.
Yeah, I'd love to see you in a sheepskin skirt.
Anyway, just go to www.patreon.com/deadideaspod and you can make that happen.
Also, don't actually send the samples of yeast in the mail. That will get you arrested.
Yeah.
Also, keep an eye on
that
date
line. Please don't. next time when we pick up with the Cuneiform series in 2 weeks, we are going to keep the orgiastic party going and we'll be talking about Sumerian erotic love poetry.
Lettuce!
Woo! Sprouting!
So you don't want to miss that. Thank you, Nick. And thank you, Anna. And
I know how to answer. Hi!
And thank you, Rachel, for being on the show.
I'm sure we'll have great breath this evening.
And you and I will enjoy it aplenty.
Yes.
Together. See you next time, everybody. I'm BT Newberg, and this is Dead Ideas.
So now we know how Rachel and Brandon spend their evenings.
Breathing
in. Yeah, just sitting on a couch breathing.
Just a snowball of garlic breath.
Yeah.
Yeah, it still smells. Ah! Ha ha ha!